House State Affairs Committee will please come to order. Today on the agenda, we have one item, and that's HB 127 on the Ombudsman. This is previously heard on, looks like, March 22nd and 26th of last year. And at this point, I'd like to stop and take the roll. Please call the roll.
Representative Keller?
Here.
Representative Millett?
Excused.
Representative Christ Tompkins? Representative Gaddis?
Here.
Representative Hughes?
Here.
Representative Isaacson?
Here.
Chair Lynn?
Here. Okay. Okay. We have a lot of folks here in the audience, which is good. Nobody online. You're all in the audience where you can get to us, right? We did hear this bill last year, as I said. It looks like we had two hearings on it, and then we appointed a subcommittee on the Ombudsman. Ombudsman, to me, is a very, very important function we have in the state. And we appointed a subcommittee, and I'd like to ask Vice Chair Keller to come down and present the report of the subcommittee. You know, we'll follow that with Representative Gaddis and Reverend Christ Tompkins, if he gets in here at the appropriate time. Good morning, Vice Chair Keller.
Thank you, Chair Lynn, and thank you.
And bring the mic closer here.
Thank you, Chair Lynn, and thank you for this opportunity. I'm Wes Keller, Representative of District 7 up in the Wasilla area. The Ombudsman law is a pretty unique law because it defines on who we are. It talks about who we are. It actually defines us as legislators. In my worldview, the founding fathers had it figured out. They built in so many checks and balances. They believed, and I also, that whenever we give government the power to regulate, there's a potential, I should say, for maladministration. Power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. We all know all that. That's why we have the three branches of government. We've made a system that is pretty inefficient and actually expensive, and it's all for the purpose of making sure that government doesn't step on the liberties of the people of the governed. The Ombudsman, we got the three branches because of that, obviously, the legislative and the executive and the judicial. The Ombudsman, the reason this bill is significant to us, the Ombudsman works for the legislature. The Ombudsman by law is both as independent as we could make the Ombudsman in law. And we've given also the Ombudsman, the legislature has, as much investigative powers as we could give in the parameter of who we are as legislators. it's really important to keep in mind as we go through this that Ombudsman power is investigative power. It gets a lot of time paralleled with the word oversight. The Ombudsman does not oversee in the sense that there's no power there to administrate. There's no power to penalize. It's to investigate what's going on when they receive a complaint that somebody is being somebody's liberty is being stepped on or by government. My personal interest is kind of longstanding. I've been interested in the Ombudsman's office ever since I learned about it about 10 years ago. This summer I went with Ombudsman Linda Lord Jenkins to the National Ombudsman Convention. I even took some elementary courses and got certificate to prove it. So that doesn't make me an expert, but I think I can maybe explain and provide a context for the important policy decisions that the committee has to decide on. Chair Lynn, as he said, appointed me as chair of the subcommittee with Representative Gaddis and Representative Jonathan Christ Thompson. I originally envisioned that the subcommittee would work, maybe even all go to the convention during the interim, but resources prevented that. Frankly, we have met one time during session and talked and worked on the CS that we're going to present here in a bit. My staff, Jim Pound, and I met with the Ombudsman several times in working out the different things, and the Ombudsman will be here to actually describe what's in the CS. I'm not going to try to do that. The subcommittee's not going to try to do that. We'll have them come forward here in a bit. I intended originally to provide a side-by-side, to say, okay, this is what was in the original bill. This is the change. as we tried to do that, we realized we'd be in the weeds immediately. So it's better to give a 50,000-foot perspective, I think, and then let the ombudsman describe what's in the CS. What I've done is I provided you each with a total package of the law, the existing law and statutes there in front of you, in whatever, five, six pages, whatever it is. And I want to just go through it really quickly with you to show you what's in there. And it'll help, I think, us understand and give us the 50,000-foot perspective. Again, there's still probably maybe work to be done on the CS. We're not intending to provide this to you as a proposing it as a state affairs work. There's perhaps amendments that need to be made, and so that's pending. If you look at page one of the law, just real briefly, I want to go through this. It talks about the section 2455020 talks about how the ombudsman is appointed, and what it is a group of senators and representatives make a proposal, and then two-thirds vote is required to put a ombudsman in place. The governor, now we're talking about the three branches here, remember, keep in mind we're keeping a balance. So they gave the authors of the bill, the legislature gave the governor the right to veto a proposal that's put forth by the legislature, and then said that the legislature can override that veto with the same vote as they pick to put the ombudsman in power. So it doesn't really give the governor power other than to say, hey, we don't like this person, but we have the lies.
Would you clarify that, please? To override what? Like a complaint is made, the ombudsman, where are we here?
Thank you. I'm sorry. I wasn't clear. No, we're just talking about how the ombudsman gets appointed.
Appointed. Okay.
Yeah, it's two-thirds vote, both houses. The governor can veto the appointment, but then we can override the veto with a two-thirds vote.
Similar to a bill.
Similar, yeah. Okay. So then it talks about, in the next section there, on the first page, it talks about the qualifications and the prohibition for the ombudsman to be involved in political items. If you look at the top of the second page, it talks about the term of office. There's a term limit for the ombudsman. It's three terms, 5 years each, not served more than three terms. There's a provision in 2455050 for the removal of an ombudsman. Okay, you get down to 2455060, it talks about the compensation for the ombudsman. That's the first section of the bill. There's a change there, and that's why I highlighted that. That's what I did, is I highlighted just the sections that the CS addresses. The next one, 2455070, staff and delegation, that also, that's section 2. It adds a new subsection D in that section of law. And then on the next page, 3 there.
I want to add on the salary. It goes to range 26. What is it today?
It is a range. This is existing law.
Okay, so yeah. There's no change in the compensation.
I would like to have the ombudsman's office go through this and give those kind of details, but what it does, this is restricted to no-step changes, and I think the CS allows for step increases. So, yes, I think there would be a change in there.
And then finally, when we get done with this part here, and have somebody, maybe you make a motion to adopt the CS, but let's continue here.
Okay, yeah.
Yes, Representative Hughes.
Representative Keller, I know that you're just trying to tell us the baseline where we are, but I think I was confused too. If you could just give us a hint of what the change will be and then let the ombudsman go into the detail, I think it would be helpful to us.
Okay, yeah, I don't mean to be, what's the word? Obscure here. what I'm trying to do is, in this overview of that I'm going over the whole law, the sections I have highlighted in yellow are the ones that actually make the changes. The changes that the CS proposes to the existing law. I think you'll learn that by and large the HB 127 is almost a revisor's bill in some sense. It goes back and cleans up details and it's easy to get into the weeds, so that's why I'm trying to avoid me giving a response that is I'm not the sponsor of the bill, but keep that in mind. It says it rules by request, and so I would rather have any specific questions go to the ombudsman here shortly. So does that help?
Yeah, I guess follow-up.
To the chair, I'm sorry.
Could be a general, you know, if, for instance, on that one, range 26, it, you know, that there, if you could just touch on what the change is without going into the weeds, that's okay. That's all I ask.
Representative Hughes, through the chair, if you will permit me, I still would like to press on the overview, but that will be answered because my staff is also going to give a description of those changes, but I'll do the best I can on that. Back down on the middle page, too, there, the staff and delegation, like I said, there's a new subsection D, and I'm not going to get into what subsection D does because I don't want to add confusion to the process. I would rather wait on that. On page 3, I would just want to point out that in 2455090, the ombudsman has power to write regulations. You know, and by regulation, set up the process by which they handle the complaints. 2455100 talks about the jurisdiction of the ombudsman's office, very clear. And then 2455110 on page 3 there, it's worth looking at this because it helps us understand what the ombudsman does. It says the ombudsman shall investigate any complaints that are appropriate according to another section that we'll be getting to here in a bit, unless there are 6 things here that the ombudsman has the option of saying, no, we're not going to investigate this complaint. And it's worth looking at. You know, it really is. I'll go through them really quick. One is if there's already a remedy there. You know, if the complaint is handled and the remedy is available. Another one is if it's outside the jurisdiction. So the ombudsman has a responsibility of saying, no, we can't investigate Alaska Airlines, for example, or whatever. You know, it's outside the jurisdiction. The third thing is that if it's been a long time, you know, if a complainant comes in and it was a complaint that happened 20 years ago, she has the option of saying, no, that's over. The complainant if it's not first person, if you come in there and you're complaining for another person, that's she can say no. I say she because the current ombudsman is Linda Lord Jenkins, and I keep that's.
I want to note that our friend Representative Christ Tompkins has now arrived, and so the investigative power to investigate whom would that be? All some incident in all 3 branches of government, or just 1 branch, or 2 branches.
There's restrictions on what we can investigate in the judicial branch, but it definitely includes the executive branch. And as you remember, the first part of the title of the original bill was a clarification of whether or not the ombudsman has jurisdiction over the Alaska Bar Association. And what we did is we took that section out, just in general terms, you'll learn more about that, and then we just went into our definition section and clarified that an instrumentality of the state, which is what the Alaska Bar Association is referred to, is the same as an agency. Now, that doesn't mean that the Ombudsman's Office has the power to investigate things that the Supreme Court has jurisdiction over. I mean, that doesn't mean that. But the Alaska Bar Association has a lot more things going other than the criteria for whether or not somebody should be an attorney, or that the intent, there's some areas in the judicial branch where we as legislators don't have the power to investigate. That's obvious. There's 3 separate branches, and we have lines. And of course, there's a certain amount of competition. But it's really to our best interest to make sure that we maintain the responsibility and the power we have on behalf of the. Of Alaskans. So anyway, that's a long answer to your question, but the other reasons the ombudsman can choose not to is if it's a bad faith complaint or if there's no resources. And the reason I wanted to get to this one, I wouldn't have pressed on so tenaciously here, but if there's no resources for a complaint, the ombudsman can say, no, we're not going to investigate that complainant. Well, that comes right back on us because we're the appropriator of funds. Therefore, we need to know if there's complaints that aren't being handled because we haven't appropriated the funds. the ombudsman also can, on her own, initiate an investigation. On page four there, two things. I just want to point out one thing. There's a notice to the complainant on 2455-130 and a notice to the agency. To me, it just stood out that there's nothing here required by the ombudsman to notify the legislature. Well, that's for good reason. I mean, she works, again, for the legislature, and there's a certain presumption, I think, there. And, of course, it's covered in the annual report that is intended for the public. But we also have that. So that has always been a concern of mine, that we want to make sure that the legislators have good interaction with the ombudsman. Section 2455-150 on page 4, very important, I think, for us to take a few minutes. I'm not going to take long here, but I really think it's worth looking at that. And we have opportunity here as this bill is before us. If you see things that are not included in Section 150 that ought to be, this would be the appropriate time here in State Affairs to consider that. But the appropriate subjects for investigation by the ombudsman are things that are contrary to law, unreasonable, unfair, oppressive, arbitrary, capricious, and abuse of discretion, or unnecessarily discriminatory, based on fact, improper, irrelevant grounds. I'm not going to read them all, but the point is my staff, Jim, and I sat down and tried to come up with something we could add in this section just to make sure that the section of law is before us all as legislators. Frankly, we couldn't come up with anything that probably wasn't covered already. So if you would just look at that. Page 5, top of it, is another section of the CS that changes. That's 2455-160, and that has to do with the procedures. And there's a new subsection C. Again, I'm not going to describe at this point what that does specifically. I'll leave that to the staff and to the ombudsman. The reason I wanted to point out here this next one on page 5, 2455-170, the powers, is to point out that there's only a couple states in the United States that have given the ombudsman this much power. The ombudsman has the power to subpoena somebody to get information. And I think that is, excellent. After going to the convention, it was very obvious that the ombudsman law in Alaska is a model piece of legislation. Other states look up to the way we do it up here. And I think that's one of the really important section of the law that the CS does not address, but it's in there. Page 6 gives a procedure after the investigation, and it talks there about the reporting to the complainant, mostly to the agency there, and that's confidential. 2455-200 there in the bottom of page 6 is very interesting. It gives the ombudsman the option. It's a may. It may present the opinions and the findings that she has to the public, to the governor, to the legislature, grand jury, or the public, or any of these. And so, you have this natural thing of not wanting anybody looking over your shoulder. And again, I point out the role of the ombudsman is investigative, but the fact that she may put this out, for us to see, is only a threat to those, that don't like the transparency. But I mean, it is something there, that makes it gives them it gives the ombudsman a lot of power. Page 7 there of the law just talks about the annual report, a very important thing, especially for us legislators to know what's going on. You see the exemption there, 2455-240. The report review of what the ombudsman has done is only there to make sure that this chapter of law has been followed. I mean, it's a pretty restrictive. And then talks 2455 55-250 talks about the immunity of the ombudsman. And then we get to 2455-260, and that is another section that the CS addresses. And it has to do with the ombudsman's privilege not to testify in court. It makes it more clear, you know, that the courts can't force the ombudsman to testify. 2455-275 is the contract procedures, and I know there's a lot of interest in that, and something that the committee will have to address. The question is whether or not the ombudsman has jurisdiction to investigate contractors for the state where the money has gone indirectly to the contractors, and it's power to investigate. And I want to be quick to add here that it's very, very clear that the legislative audit has jurisdiction over contractors, and I think that that is something that has a parallel here, and I can get you the legal memos on that I've reviewed. It's that's a decision that I'm casting back on to the committee as a whole. Last thing that I'm going to mention is on page 8 there in the definitions. If you look down there under the definition of agency, you'll see that we have included in that the word instrumentality. You'll see that in the CS. That's another change in the CS. With that, if there's no questions, that you want me to answer, I would like you to give my staff just a few minutes to overview the CS, and then I would like to come back up and take the bill back.
I'd like to hear from Mr. Pound, and then a brief comments from the other members of the subcommittee, which would be Representative Gaddis and Representative Christ-Tompkins. Mr. Pound, please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. For the record, my name is Jim Pound. I'm Staff Representative Keller, and I worked with the subcommittee on House Bill 127. Essentially, what we have done with 127, and without getting into the specifics of the CS at the present time, is that we have transformed it into a comprehensive piece of legislation. Unlike a lot of subcommittees, we actually reduced the size of the bill by a couple of pages.
That's good.
And so, as Representative Keller had indicated, it is a revisor's bill of sort. It corrects how the ombudsman is paid. It does add the step increases to her pay, or his pay, whichever the case may be down the road. Expands how the ombudsman can protect attorney-client privilege. It updates the procurement procedure. It allows it to change as necessary. Essentially, what has happened is that the procurement process for the ombudsman had been different than the way it is for the standard for the legislature. It brings their procurement into the same compliance as ours. It looks at the growing trend of privatization by the government by permitting investigation into those private contractors. More and more we're doing it. Our prison system is a perfect example. Some transportation contracts are going out to private contractors. Technically, those private contractors do represent the state, and if someone has a complaint, they can come to the ombudsman. House Bill 127 expands the authority of the ombudsman to review instrumentalities. Instrumentalities of the state is actually a quite common term. In a quick review of the Alaska statute, there's 121 references to instrumentality. Not all of them are of the state. Some of them are to the federal government, but there are 121 references, and there's a whole shopping list of organizations within the state that are, in fact, instrumentalities. And from that, I'd like to take a look at the R version, which is what we discussed, which is the bill you have before you, and give you a quick overview of what the subcommittee decided to do, which would ultimately end up leaving you with the CS if that is the choice of the committee to go ahead and adopt the CS at that time. In the R version, which is the bill that is still before you, the clarifying language of the Alaska Bar Association in the title has been deleted, as has Section 1, which references the Alaska Bar Association, that is taken up under instrumentality of the state. We come down to Section 3, where we are dealing primarily with confidentiality. That is covered under Section 10 of the bill, which is on page 4, line 9, and also in regulation, which is 21 AAC 10.200. And Section 6 of the bill was deleted as well. Reporting language, which is already on the books and can also be handled by regulation. And that goes all the way through, eliminating all of page 3 from the bill. to include Section 300 complaints and responses, which are already in regulatory language. Section 11, where we have added language, which is actually the language that's already in the R version, that deals, again, with the procurement situation. If we go over to page 5, you'll notice that there's a 5% preference under. That language is already in the state of Alaska's legislative language and is unnecessary in this bill. It's just duplicative.
Question?
Yes.
Excuse me, Representative Isaacson.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Jim, you're saying Section 11 is essentially Section 5, and Section 5 has become miniaturized. Am I hearing that right?
Chair, I need a
little louder, please.
I need a copy of version R. I don't have it.
Mr. Chair, while we're waiting, do you mind if I come back up?
What's that?
Do you mind if I come back up?
No, you're vice chairman. Good job.
Oh, that seems to be the same.
Okay. So, where are you?
No, I guess section 11 in R is section 7 in G, so that is the same. I thought I heard you saying it was something, it had been revised.
The chair has been revised. I'm just going through the R version right now. I mean, it'll, when the G version comes, we'll let the ombudsman address that because they're better versed on what it does and doesn't do.
Mr. Chair.
Vice Chair Keller.
Thank you, Chair Lynn. As part of the report, I do owe an apology to the committee. We did not get the blank CSTU till today, and it was I'm embarrassed about that, and it was an oversight in the hassle of keeping all the papers in the air. So it wasn't at all an intent to prevent you from having it. And
you've been a little busy in your other committee.
Yeah, thanks.
As I said, Section 11, Mr. Chair, is the procurement code that brings it into the same compliance as what the legislature already uses in the Legislative Affairs Agency. Section 12 is probably the language that's going to have the most discussion today, which is instrumentality. As I had indicated, in instrumentality, there are 121 references in state statute to it. Some of the organizations that are instrumentalities in the state of Alaska are the Alaska Medical Facilities Authority, Alaska State Housing Authority, Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, Kanikarm Bridge and Toll Authority, Alaska Gasline Development Corporation, the Alaska Permanent Fund. I mean, this list goes on and on and on. Now, it's not to say that the Ombudsman has not had the ability to investigate in the past these instrumentalities. However, this puts it in the statute and verifies they do, in fact, have the authority to investigate instrumentalities. Excuse me, let me get caught back up here. In Section 13, we're primarily dealing with providing a service listed. We reference that back up to the previous paragraph so that it's private contractors that are primarily dealing in the custodial area of statute. And the last section is an indirect court rule amendment, which may or may not be needed depending on how the courts may review or view the inclusion of the Alaska Bar as an instrumentality of the state and what authority that the Supreme Court may decide that we do or do not have. Which, if this ends up in court, will be where we end up there. And that essentially is what the subcommittee has decided to do with our version, which was the version that was before you, which you have in front of you now, sir, as the as a proposed CS, which is the G version.
More family friendly.
Is that it?
That is it, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Representative Lynn Gaddis. Would you like to go down here and make comments from here?
I'll just make comments from here, if that's okay.
That's fine.
Can move this along. Thank you, Representative Keller, and your staff, because that pretty well, you know, accentuated what the what we worked on. Having gone down and worked with the ombudsman, you know, became clear that we did have some cleanup that needed to be done, and that's what I consider this bill is a cleanup. That you know, there's some things that you know were older that needed to be addressed, and quite frankly, that's what the ombudsman needs to do is work for us. And there were some areas that they were not able to work for us, and collaborating with, and I was I'll admit being one of those that. Was challenged with some of the things that I thought that the ombuds was doing. So as we got together, as we compromised, I think that the bill looks pretty good at this point. And, you know, I would highly recommend that my colleagues take a good look at it. But I think that we did clean it up over the interim, and I think it's a good piece of legislation. So with that, that's
Thank
what
you
I
very much.
You're welcome.
Reverend Christ Tompkins, you're on a subcommittee. Do you have any comments at this point?
I'm looking at the committee substitute for the first time right now, which troubles me greatly because I'm on the subcommittee that supposedly produced this committee substitute. I appreciate that the intentions were good and that things get busy, but I'm in the same position as everyone else on the committee right now reading this for the first time.
Okay, thank you. With that, I'll entertain a motion to adopt the CS. Don't everybody speak at one time.
Mr. Chair, I would like to adopt the State Affairs to adopt the CS for House Bill 127. That's version LS0088 Gulf.
Back to Gulf. Okay. Any objection? Without objection, we will be working with backslash G version of the bill. Okay. I guess the best thing to do from now is to take other testimony. As Mr. Powell, do you have anything else you'd like to add at this time?
No, Mr. Chairman, and I believe that the Ombudsman would like to address the G version of it and probably give you the best explanation of it as well.
Thank you very much. Would the Ombudsman please come forward? Now, we're okay for time at this point. That's why we didn't schedule any other bill along with this bill, so we'd have a reasonable amount of time to discuss the bill. I hope we can move out the bill in some fashion today. That's why we took the entire period of time for the State Affairs Committee today. Please introduce yourself and make your comments.
Mr. Chairman, my name is
Nice
Linda
and loud, please.
I'm sorry. Mr. Chairman, my name is Linda Lord Jenkins, and I'm the State of Alaska Ombudsman.
Yeah. Just move the microphone forward.
Forward or back?
Yeah,
forward. Okay. You can tell I don't do this very often. I want to thank you for scheduling this hearing today and taking as much time as you have devoted to considering our legislation. I would also like to thank Representative Keller and Representative Gaddis for attending the USOA, the United States Ombudsman Association.
Again, would you please move the microphone forward? Just move the whole microphone forward.
It's okay.
Yeah, slide it this way.
Okay. Too loud or too soft? Lean in. Okay.
Okay, thank you.
I would also like to thank Representative Keller and Representative Gaddis for doing some fact-finding when they attended the United States Ombudsman Association conference in Indianapolis this fall. Representative Keller was actually a student of mine. I run the new ombudsman training. It's a two-day training for new ombudsmen in the governmental sector. And Representative Keller was there and posed a lot of interesting questions that gave us lots of things to think about, and I do appreciate that level of interest in our bill. As Representative Keller said earlier, we proposed this bill as a cleanup bill. The Ombudsman's Office was created in 1976. There were some revisions to the statute in 1986 and again in 1990, but not since then. And slowly things have some of the items in the bill just presented themselves, like the procurement revisions. because that we needed to clean up. And there are other issues that we decided as time has changed and government has changed that we saw the necessity, or we think it's a need to amend the bill slightly. So that's why we have come up with the bill. I think independently, most of these would not have stood on their own. We wouldn't have troubled the legislature with each individual one, but as a group, we felt the need to bring this legislation forward. The first piece of the legislation is Section 1, which has to do with the compensation of the ombudsman. Under the United States Ombudsman Act, model acts and standards, USOA and the Ombudsman International Ombudsman Institute suggests that ombudsmen should have a position in government where they can deal on an equal power level with department heads, because they are making suggestions often to department heads on how to rectify problems that have been have been discovered through ombudsman investigation. When the ombudsman was created, the office was created in Alaska, the ombudsman was compensated on a level equal to a superior court judge. That compensation was reduced in 1986, and the compensation was set at a level, a range 26 and locked in, which means that it's a 26A, and it does not change. So anyone who works in the office, in essence, does not get a merit step. My understanding from talking to LAA Human Resource Director Skip Lobaugh is that the ombudsman now is the only position in state government that does not get that step increase. It's not entitled to a consideration for the step increase. Whether this section would ever apply to me or not, I think that's fundamentally unfair to the position of the ombudsman. And so that's why we have moved to revise that. The Section 2 talks about appointing ombudsman staff under personnel contracts. I'm going to ask Assistant Ombudsman Beth Leibowitz, who serves as in-house counsel and an investigator for the office, to explain the need for this provision.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself.
I'm Beth Leibowitz. I'm an Assistant Ombudsman with the Office of the Ombudsman, and I'm also an attorney, so I tend to look at things like the statutory revision when they come up. And so this section is because the Ombudsman's office is in the legislative branch, but has been in some ways separated from other legislative personnel matters. There's been a lot of statute revisions over the years dealing with legislative personnel, and we found ourselves in a sort of odd limbo where it appears that we do have the ability to use that type of personal services contract, but it is not crystal clear. And so we've asked for our amendment to simply clarify that so there is no longer any confusion on the issue.
Okay. Any questions on that? Okay. Continue, somebody.
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We, in Section 3, we would add a subsection to Statute 2455-160 that addresses our access to attorney-client privileged information. When the Ombudsman Act was first enacted in 76, the Ombudsman did have access to attorney-client privileged information, but that was revised in 1990 to exclude attorney-client privileged information from our review. What this means is that if, practically speaking, if the Department of Law is asked for an opinion by a social worker for the Office of Children's Services and the social worker acts on that attorney's advice, we get a complaint about an action involved in that case, we do not have access to see what law has advised the OCS social worker. So we can't look at, because of that, we can't look at all of the evidence in a complaint that comes before us. Our understanding is that in large part this is because if privilege was waived as to the ombudsman, the privilege is then considered waived as to any other entity. I am not an attorney, but that is my understanding. This provision would allow us to review the attorney-client privilege information or work product, but that privilege, that would not allow anyone else involved in, say, a lawsuit to look at that information. Am I clear on that?
Well, I'm a little confused. Probably me, but can you give me a hypothetical on this? How you're investigating Susie Jones, right? And what happens here?
To the chair, this is actually reflecting in a case that we did see several years ago, where it involved, I believe it was Department of then Community and Regional Affairs, and the particular division had some, there was a complaint, and we looked at it, and we said, why did you do X? And they said, well, our attorney told us to, and I said, well, what did your attorney tell, you know, what did your attorney tell you? And they said, well, we can't tell you that. And actually, it probably would have been to their advantage to show us what the Department of Law told them, because one of the things we will give an agency a pass on is if they're acting on advice of counsel and that's the reason for their
action,
conduct, then, you know, we'll say, well, you know, hey, that's reasonable. You asked your attorney for advice. It looks like you got it. But if they can't or won't show us, then we're left with something that looks, frankly, unexplainable, and that is reflected in our investigation.
Then how do you report that without compromising the attorney-client privilege?
Well, if they're in, we have had agencies that have given us arguably privileged material to explain it, and so far that has not been a problem for them. But we have had agencies also say, oh, we can't do that. And if it can play out that it can reflect in the investigation where essentially our conclusions will be that the agency's action does not appear reasonable because we do not have a reasonable explanation. That's one way it will play out. What we would like to do in this is basically facilitate agencies sharing that information with us when we ask them, why did you do X? We would like them to be able to say, oh, well, here's why, and not have it come back and bite them in litigation with another party.
Any questions on that point?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gannis.
And I don't think this is a question, but more of a statement. As I get many, many requests in regards to OCS issues, I mean, there is really a brick wall allowing the citizens of Alaska to be able to get help through the OCS. And I don't mean to be pounding on OCS. Actually, I do mean to be pounding on OCS today, because that's a huge issue, and their hands are tied. And I think that this allows their hands to be untied to be able to do the business that I think that the citizens of Alaska really deserve. So, I mean, this particular portion in the bill, I think, is huge.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Thanks for the clarification. Please continue.
Mr. Chair, may I just add one other thing? We have had cases where we've conducted formal investigations where the agency inadvertently provided us attorney-client information that was pivotal on at least one aspect of the investigation. And our practice is, because our statute says that we cannot release information that is confidential, we do not release that information publicly. We do not release it to the complainant, but we can incorporate that into a confidential version of the public of the report that we provide to the agency. And so the agency understands what has happened, and we provide that information to law if appropriate to say, well, the agency did not follow your advice, and you might want to talk to them about that. But we don't release confidential information in any respect, and we wouldn't release attorney-client privilege information in any respect. So that is our practice there.
Thank you. Do one of you continue on?
Section 4 tightens up these.
And identify yourself.
I'm sorry. This is Linda Lord Jenkins again. Section 4 tightens up the ombudsman's confidentiality of records. When the Ombudsman Act was first enacted, we relied on the Ombudsman's privilege not to testify in court to protect our records. And as the years have gone by, We have still defended our records, but we feel that it should the we wanted that provision tightened up. So we have added section 4B, which keeps our notes, drafts, records obtained from an individual or agency are not releasable to the public. And this goes along with our strong confidentiality provisions, which again are core to an ombudsman's the ombudsman institution.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Isaacson.
Thank you. Linda, I'm not sure if it goes, if I could, with your indulgence and the chair's indulgence, go back to section 3. I've been mulling over the written testimony that we got from North Star, and I don't know if it fit back in section 3 or if it's going to go to section 6 under instrumentality, but it has to do with, you know, some of the agencies requesting exemption from ombudsman. And one of the points that they talk about is the fact that they have inherent benefit of having an internal advocate who can investigate and work with the clinical team to address concerns, thus preventing triangulation and preserve the therapeutic alliance between patient and treatment team, and the idea that their clients are admitted voluntarily. So my question, Mr. Chair, through the chair to Ms. Lord Jenkins, is this the instrumentality part, or is this the attorney-client privilege part, or a combination of both, or even the larger idea of ombudsman as we've been hearing? Because as we've been listening to the testimony of the first presenter and then yourself, I've been trying to figure out, legislatively, we're supposed to be doing this. We're supposed to be looking to make sure all of the agencies and those being funded by the legislature are actually using these funds appropriately and are using process appropriately. Maybe if you could, I'm not even sure how to frame the question, but if you could address the concern that they had that maybe having an ombudsman is going to interfere in the best treatment for a client. And this goes kind of back to the OCS question. And like Ms. Representative Gaddis, I'm kind of frustrated by sometimes a stonewalled approach. But could you address that now? Because it seems to fit into this part.
To the chair, this is Beth Leibowitz. And the concerns regarding North Star actually do not tie to Section 3, which deals with the attorney-client relationship between agencies, usually executive branch agencies and the Department of Law, as far as we're concerned. In fact, it ties to Section 6, to the part dealing with contractors or grantees.
Okay, so we can wait until then, Mr. Chair.
So it doesn't have, it's not actually tied to the instrumentality phrasing, nor is it tied to Section 3.
Oh, it's not tied to either through the chair.
It's tied to the portion that deals with, in Section 6, it deals with contractors or grantees providing services for the state.
All right. So with the chair's indulgence.
Please continue.
Well, we'll go hit it. If you'll hit this again when we get there. Thank you.
Okay.
We're in Section 6?
Back to 4. I guess I don't want to skip 4 and 5, so we can go back to 4. I just didn't want to get too far ahead if we were in Section 3.
Okay.
Thank you.
To the chair, this is Beth Leibowitz again. It's mentioning Section 5, contract procedures. This deals with the fact that several versions of the procurement code ago, we had some language put into our statute, and the procurement code moved on, and we were left with what appears to be an anachronistic reference. It caused us to be the only legislative branch agency that would be making procurement regulations tied to 3630 rather than to the legislative procurement policies that everyone else in the legislative branch is using. And the Section 5 is designed to basically put us back in the legislative branch as far as procurement goes.
That work? Thank you. Please continue.
We'll get to my question here in a moment. Thank you.
No problem.
Okay. is moving on to Section 6, which I suspect is why there is actually an audience for otherwise unexciting piece of legislation.
They just like us, that's all. Best show in town.
Thank you. So the first part of this, Section 6 has two issues in it. The first one is the inclusion of instrumentality in the definition of what is an agency for the purposes of the ombudsman. And I should say that over the years, we have had no problem asserting jurisdiction with regard to the University of Alaska or Alaska Housing Finance Corporation or a number of other entities, some of which are instrumentalities. However, we have had a long-running ambiguity with regard to the Bar Association, which looks like an administrative agency in many respects, but is defined only as an instrumentality and has generally said that they are not within our jurisdiction. We have had a choice over the years of either litigating a test case or asking the legislature to resolve this one way or the other, and we've asked the legislature to basically make the coin flip and tell us whether or not we are supposed to have jurisdiction over that particular instrument.
Whatever we do, we're not going to flip a coin.
Okay. Yeah. You get but it is fundamentally your call. And so we've asked you to make that call.
And we will after we get testimony from folks.
Yeah. And then to the chair, the other chunk of this, it deals with the fact that since the Ombudsman's Office has created more services that were traditionally services done by state agencies, have moved into the private sector or quasi-private area. And so we looked at this and we said we cannot reasonably supervise or investigate every contract or grant issued by the state of Alaska. So we looked at that and said, what are the categories where we think that the state's privatization is really in a critical enough area that we should have jurisdiction despite the privatization? And we looked at that and said, okay, first and foremost, adults in state custody, that is, correctional inmates. If they're in Lemon Creek, they're within our jurisdiction. If they're in a private facility in Colorado, as they used to be until quite recently, suddenly the institution is no longer part of our jurisdiction, and we have only the most indirect access to deal with the issues. And similar matter with halfway houses. They're private contractors. And so the inmate who was in Lemon Creek, who was in an institution over which we had jurisdiction, goes to a halfway house, and they may have some of the same types of issues they had while they were in Lemon Creek, but we do not have direct jurisdiction to investigate what's going on there. And so that is the first and foremost category where we've seen the most demonstrated need to remove the distinction between Department of Corrections and contractors. And that is, you know, we've had enough cases involving private facilities that we think that there's a demonstrated need in that area.
So then you would be working primarily for the person in the facility, trying to work with them, protect them, do whatever with them, and that's more important than the facility. It's the person within the facility, whether it's Lemon Creek or Plowed Field, Arkansas.
To the chair, it's basically whether the complaint is merited or not, if they're an inmate, they're in state power. And we don't want our jurisdiction to be limited by whether they're in state power and they're housed in Goose Creek, Lemon Creek, or in a contract facility, whether that's a halfway house or whether the state is eventually obliged by population pressure to use another out-of-state private facility like Hudson or Red Rock, which were in use until quite recently.
Understood. Please continue.
Okay. The next category is the category of, juveniles, but juveniles in state custody. And this is the area where if they're in McLaughlin or Johnson Youth Center here in Juneau, they're in a facility that is clearly within our jurisdiction. And those facilities provide treatment. Their orientation is far more therapeutic than the adult facilities, but they are state, basically state agency facilities, and juveniles are in custody there. Now, juveniles will often be moved from those or not go to those because they will be in basically a lower level of care. They don't have to be as strictly locked up, but they're in one of many nonprofits that provide residential care for juveniles who are in state custody. And again, the orientation is far more therapeutic than an adult halfway house, but these are individuals, minors, but individuals who are in state custody, and they are being placed in at least a quasi-institutional environment. And so we've asked for jurisdiction over a certain set of facilities that deal with those juveniles.
Okay.
And finally, we've asked for jurisdiction over a category that is a bit of a catch-all, but is basically contractors or grantees that determine eligibility for a state program or benefit. And for instance, there's a couple of nonprofits who are contracted to actually determine eligibility for daycare assistance. That's a pretty minor thing in the big scheme of things, but it's important to the people who are looking for daycare assistance. If it's in an area where the Division of Public Assistance is handling it directly, they can bring us the complaint. If it's been contracted or put out to a grantee for that same determination, then suddenly it's not really within our jurisdiction. And so basically, if a contractor or grantee is serving as the gatekeeper to a state service, we would like the jurisdiction. If it can be handled by referring it back to the agency that did the contractor grant, you know, we're happy to do that and let them take care of their own, you know, contractor. But we believe we need the option of having direct jurisdiction if matters aren't being handled.
Okay. Any question? Continue. Oh, wait a minute.
Well, Isaacs. I think she's coming up to it. Okay. You are coming up to my question.
Okay. If you mean... To the chair, does the representative mean Section 7?
No, Section 6 through the chair. Because it isn't just the child care, it says also residential psychiatric treatment center, et cetera. Again, you're looking at jurisdictions that are gatekeepers to a state service. Kind of like that phrase. That helps clarify. So a state service... Some of these have that privacy aspect, client-attorney privilege, as it were, or, you know, client-doctor-physician privilege. And some of it has, you know, their voluntary treatment centers, such as the latter. And so there's this idea that I brought up with this written testimony that I read. Where they have an internal advocate who can investigate and work with the clinical team to address concerns. I'm curious how, if somebody who is filing a complaint, or family member usually filing a complaint due to treatment or procedure or something, how do you interact as an ombudsman's office with the treatment center, with this gatekeeper of the state service? They're saying that perhaps it's not constructive to have the ombudsman involved with it as well. I'm asking you for justification for being directly involved.
Representative Isaacson, through the chair, this is Linda Lord Jenkins. It is the ombudsman's practice in most cases that if there is an available process, we will route the complainant through the process if there is a complaint. And if they have a grievance process, an appeal process, we generally route individual complainants through that process. However, people still frequently feel that they have not been treated fairly, that the agency's action is not fair or reasonable or inconsistent with their policies and procedures. And we can then look at that, what the agency has done in response to an individual complaint. That's how we do most of our work. We only have 10 people on staff. We don't have time to handle each and every complaint that comes to us about all agencies, we give them information about the available process. So what we would say is, we would, if there is a grievance process, show it to us, tell us what it is, and we will instruct the complainant to go through that process. Happily, we will do that. But one of the concerns that I have seen was presented by the Mental Health Board that we were violating Ombudsman best practice standards by asking for this. This is not uncommon. The ombudsman in Iowa, the ombudsman in Nebraska, both have the ability to look at contractors for health and social service agency services. The Dayton ombudsman follows the money. They don't have statutory authority, but they follow the money is how they put it. And if a government agency pays a contractor for a service that is being delivered on behalf of the government agency, they have jurisdiction. They take jurisdiction. If the state of Alaska has a therapeutic residential home that it can put a child in, that child would be subject to the jurisdiction of the ombudsman. If the state of Alaska does not have that home and contracts with a private entity to put a child in state supervision, in the custody of that entity, why do they then lose their right to have the ombudsman oversight?
Mr. Chair, if I could
continue.
So I just want to summarize to make sure for the record that I heard you correctly, mm-hmm. and that's simply that as you see this section of dealing with instrumentalities, you are going to first refer a complaint to the process. You'll interact with the instrumentality to find out what the process is. If they have a process, then you direct the complainant to that process. If the complainant still has an objection to something procedural or the care or they feel that they've been somehow disenfranchised from the process of getting their complaint heard, that's when you step in. And that means then that they have final recourse. If I may, and that's important because some of our agencies, they're all good, but sometimes they can get siloed, and we run across this, and sometimes the families don't always feel that their voice is heard. So if it weren't for the ombudsman, what would the recourse be for the families that don't feel like their complaint is being heard? Do they have to go to court, or what is the process, or is they just throw up their hands like so many do and say, I guess I just can't beat the system, or what?
One of Representative Isaacson through the chair, this is Linda Lur Jenkins, court review would be one of the options if they have gone as far as they want. My understanding is if these young people have been committed to the custody of DHSS and DHSS, with the agreement of the family, puts this child in a residential home, presumably they could go to court and ask for some sort of oversight. But one of the reasons the ombudsman exists in America is to keep people out of court sometimes. It's often much more expeditious, cheaper, and a quicker solution to have the ombudsman look at a complaint. We don't advocate for a complainant, nor do we advocate for an agency. We take a complaint and we look to see if the agency is acting in accordance with their statutes, their regulations, their policies and procedures, best practices. And if they are not, we make recommendations, which it's been pointed out in one of the documents I've seen that we do not have the power to enforce, but we make a good argument for making a change in practice, either systemically or for an individual complainant, if that's appropriate.
And, Mr. Chair, then if I may add, that latter part right there is very important, to keep people out of court, mm-hmm. to make it expeditious, and then to report to the legislature on the annual report changes that might need to be made to ensure best practices. And that's a very important part of this oversight. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Linda and Beth. You're doing an excellent job educating us. It's been 24 years, I believe, since you've had anything statute cleaned up that pertains to your work. And you mentioned that, I believe, maybe Iowa, that had kind of follow the money. You chose not to do the follow the money. You named very specifically in this Section 6. And I'm not saying that, you know, good or bad. I just want to understand why you chose that rather than a more general follow the money. And if you feel like you really covered all the bases, so there won't be some particular thing that in a few years you realize, oh, we should have had that in there, and then it'll be another 20 years before you come back to the legislature. So if you could touch on that. And then also we talked about the attorney-client privilege and what you're wanting with that. But what about when we think of North Star, the patient physician, the patient health care confidentiality privilege, how does that play in to your investigation? Would that all be, would you have access to any of that information?
Well, I got it. Representative Hughes through the chair, this is Linda Lur Jenkins. The follow the money standard came from Dayton, Ohio. And Dayton, the Dayton Ombudsman is a classical ombudsman, not unlike Alaska, Hawaii, or Iowa, and Nebraska, but they don't have a lot of enabling legislation, and so that's why they use the follow the money standard. They have jurisdiction; they're funded by city, county, and private funding sources. And there are some, they're an incorporated entity with authority to investigate complaints on behalf of Dayton citizens. So they use the follow the money standard. We prefer to have our jurisdiction set in stone, not unlike the ombudsman standards, which were referenced in the Mental Health Land Board's reaction comments on our bill. The USOA recommends that jurisdiction be very, very clear, not that jurisdiction exclude contractors, but that it be very, very clear where the line lies and that the ombudsman not extend past that jurisdiction. When we were reviewing this, the bill, and considering whether to expand the jurisdiction, whether we thought it was appropriate for what we were seeing in government, there are a lot of contractors out there doing a lot of work for the state. You know, they're on the roads every day, expanding the roads or closing the roads or fixing bridges. We simply looked to see what we thought was more critical to the well-being of people, and we thought the custodial aspect of looking at contractors that provide prison services or contractors that provide residential treatment services is more important at this point, given our resources and given what we were looking at, than judging whether or not a contractor that's hauling gravel broke somebody's windshield. We still will address that, and we will refer them to risk management. But we thought that given the resources, given the realities of the budget in the state of Alaska and resources for funding that budget, we thought that custodial aspect of this was more critical. Does that answer your question?
It does, and I still want to know about the health care provider or the patient, but as follow-up to what you've already said, what if there were something to arise that doesn't fit under here, you know, a bridge collapses and it had to do, you know, and the legislature wanted you to look into it. What if we went back to add, would it be able to be retroactive for something that occurred prior?
We have at this time, we have the ability to reach out and look at contractors and what they do, but it's a circuitous route and it's a very time-consuming route. What we do, what we have been doing with the contract facilities is if an inmate from, say, Hudson, when they were in Hudson, would call us and say, I passed out in my cell last night because I was in a diabetic coma, and my roomie buzzed the emergency and buzzed and buzzed and buzzed, and the and the private contractor's employee did not come and get me health care for 5 hours, which has, we got a complaint about that, similar to that. I paraphrased, but we can't call, we didn't call Hudson. We would have to say, you complain to the Department of the Department of Corrections. And then we looked to see how DOC responded to that complaint. And that's a very, very circuitous route. And it takes a lot of time. It took us a lot of time to look at that particular issue. And we could only touch on it peripherally, you know, what DOC did to respond to that particular complaint. That is how we would have to respond at this point, is if a bridge collapsed. We would look to see, had DOT inspected the bridge? Had DOT had adequate oversight on the contractor when the contractor was building the bridge? Who was looking at it? What were the standards? What was their training? That sort of thing. So we could do that, and presumably under a special, if the legislature decided that they wanted us to look at something, they could probably enact legislation or directive that they wanted us to look at a specific incident, perhaps in tandem with ledge audit. The legislature decided that they wanted Steve Brandflower to look at what happened in what's now known as Troopergate, and they commissioned Brandflower to look at that. So that's wasn't really set in statute. So at least, and again, I'm not an attorney, but my view on this is if the legislator wanted us to look at it, we would look at it. We could.
Representative Hughes.
And just to clarify, so if a situation like that came back and we addressed it and we added that to this section, you would be able to go back and investigate something that happened prior to the date that we added it?
The legalities, I'm going to turn over to Beth.
To Representative Hughes, through the chair, I am not sure that you could make a retroactive addition to our jurisdiction. I would suggest that you ask your own legal staff over at Ledge Legal about the feasibility of that and take their advice on what they say about it. They're the experts in looking at that exact type of issue. I'm not sure that you could do that, but I would say that that's one that you should probably send over to the folks at Ledge Legal to ask them if that's something you could do.
Continue.
And I guess just as wrap up on this one point, you are feeling very comfortable that you have included in this the things that need to be included. I'm guessing you or would presume that you're basing it on the cases that typically come before you. But when you step back and look, I'm just concerned. And I'm not saying we should open it up to follow the money, but I'm just wondering if you've really thought through anything, even if you don't have frequent quake cases or there might be something that comes up. You're comfortable with what's in here.
Representative Hughes, through the chair, at this point I am comfortable with what is in there. Follow the money is Dayton's standard. It is not our standard. In the last 5 or 10 years, we have averaged 25 to 27% of our caseload has come from health and social services. About the same number of cases have come from the Department of Corrections. So those are the big areas that we are trying to address, and those are the areas that have a lot of privatization.
Follow up.
Thank you. And so if you could please answer the question regarding the patient health care provider confidentiality and how that works when you do an investigation.
To Representative Hughes, through the chair, for medical records, patient consults, if they're done within a state agency or if a state agency has those records, we can get them. Our mandatory access to state agency records, whether confidential or not, is pretty clear. And so, yes, we get health care information pretty routinely. And like other confidential information, we hold it and we don't release it. And so, yes, we would be getting that type of access.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Representative Keller.
One more pass. Thanks.
Pass?
Yeah. sorry.
Reverend Isaacson.
Thank you. Through the chair, then. So, as you referenced the mental health letter, one of the questions that they brought up was unintended consequences, because now you'd be having jurisdiction over complaints about therapeutic foster parents. Can you address this?
This is Representative Isaacson through the chair. This is Beth Leibowitz. My understanding of what we drafted is that we were trying very hard not to pick up foster homes, therapeutic or otherwise, and the statutory definition of a residential child care facility. We basically looked at residential child care facilities or a residential psychiatric treatment center as defined by 4732-900. And the definition of a residential child care facility refers to an entity staffed by employees. And I don't think therapeutic foster parents are considered employees. They have a placement agreement with the state or with the entity, but my understanding is that a therapeutic foster home is not a residential child care facility.
Through the chair.
Go ahead.
But they are being reimbursed by the state and therefore are gatekeepers of state service.
Through the chair, they are not a gatekeeper. I mean, a foster home does not decide whether or not a kid will be placed there. They do not decide whether or not a kid will be in state custody. They don't make that decision. Gatekeeping would be the entity that decides. For instance, another example of gatekeeping would be the contractors that provide prior authorizations for Medicaid or even for regular employee health insurance, where if they decide, do you or do you not get that travel? Do you or do you not get that particular procedure authorized and paid for? That's a gatekeeping function. But a foster parent, therapeutic or otherwise, doesn't decide, oh, this kid should be in this placement. That's done by someone else, and the kid is put there.
Through the chair.
Go ahead.
But this would be a question going back to the example that the ombudsman herself referenced when perhaps there's a complaint that a client, a child in this case, was restrained or wasn't given proper attention for the 5 hours or whichever. And so if the natural parents are concerned, and I've been a foster parent, so I understand some of this, are concerned about the treatment that the foster parent is giving or lack thereof, that would be analogous, and so you would need to be investigating that because they are providing a service, you might say it's an in-house residential treatment. And, you know, they're acting as parents for the child, and sometimes these children act out, and maybe the foster parent isn't being attentive in the concern of the natural parent. I mean, in my head, I'm playing through some of the scenarios that I've lived through, as well as those that I've received complaints of this last year. So I'm thinking that they're right in the fact that you would be following through with your own line of reasoning, which I'm inclined to agree with, but you would be actually investigating complaints of foster parents because they are the first line of care, and therefore they are going to do things that others might object to.
To Representative Isaacson through the chair, we made a deliberate decision to try to basically say, no, we are not going everywhere. We are going to look at entities that are quasi-institutional, and we don't think that foster parents are in that category. And yes, we do get complaints that relate to foster parents, and we will basically talk to a JAL, we will talk to the OCS caseworker, or in some cases it's the Division of Juvenile Justice. We will talk to the, you know, we'll talk to the parents. We usually don't talk to the juvenile, but we could. And we will talk to licensing, which provides the, you know, basically we'll talk to the licensing entity, because I know that licensing for foster parents will involve fairly active investigations. I've seen the records of those. where they send the licensing worker and sometimes, and quite likely the OCS caseworker, if it's that in that category, to the foster home to visit, and they'll do it, and they'll take those complaints. And so we decided we did not have the resources or the need to go into that category. But we feel that there is a qualitative distinction between a foster home and a residential facility that is providing a less parental and more institutional type of care for juveniles who are in custody.
Through the chair. So, thank you. So, I anticipate from your comment that as this bill in its present form gives you the right or the ability to create regulation, that that would be specified in regulation. The distinction in as you just expressed it.
Through Representative Isaacson, through the chair, I think that's a reasonable presumption. I think some fairly detailed regulations will be in order.
One last thing, Mr. Chair. So going back to this and threading it through the instrumentality and the idea of foster care and residential care and so forth, one of the aspects that the mental health folks brought up also was the idea of the fiscal note. And we've already addressed the fact that if you don't have the money, you can't investigate. But they're thinking that perhaps you've underestimated instrumentality oversight, and you won't have enough funds to really dig into this section anyway. Could you address that? I mean, just in the one aspect of residential treatment centers, there's quite a number of people, and so the likelihood of complaint is high. Broaden that out to all categories of instrumentality. How do you feel that without additional staff or additional funding, you'd actually be able to do a good job in this category?
Representative Isaacson, through the chair, it's not been my practice to ask for money when I don't have the numbers to back it up. It's been my practice that that when we have a sizable increase in our caseload, I will ask for funds to address that increase. And I don't think that, I mean, my feeling is that it would be a fool's errand right now for me to say I want more money this year because this bill may pass if I saw an increase in caseload due to that area of complaints coming in. I would definitely ask for more staff, but at this point, I don't have anything to base. I would not have anything to base such a request on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
What is your approximate caseload today?
The caseload today is we're running about 1,300 complaints a year.
1,300 complaints.
But I can say that we were, for some reason, in the first 7 weeks of the year, we're up 40% over cases last year. We ran pretty static. In 2013, I think our increase was only 4%, but we're up this year, and it may be because of Goose Creek. But
thank you, Representative Kreis-Thompson, and then Representative Hughes.
In a given year, your caseload is 1,300?
Complaints.
Complaints. How many complaints do you turn away in a given year that, if this bill were to pass, would therefore be under your jurisdiction?
Representative Kreis-Thompson, through the chair, when you say turn away, I'm going to have to do a little explaining on how we handle complaints. Complaints come in on the phone, in writing, on email, and we assess that complaint to see, first of all, if it's jurisdictional, and if it is not a jurisdictional complaint, we route the caller, the complainant, to an appeal or grievance process. Or to generally, when we say they're not jurisdictional, it would be a complaint against a private business or the federal government or a state or a municipal government, borough government. That would be a non-jurisdictional complaint. Jurisdictional complaints would be a complaint that is about a state agency. And once we've established that there is jurisdiction, we then get more information about what the complainant is unhappy with. We determine what program it is. We take a look on at their policies and procedures. If there is an appeal or a grievance process, we educate people on what that grievance and appeal process is. In, using child support enforcement as an example, they have a problem resolution team. We, if the complainant has been is unhappy with how their caseworker is handling their complaint, we route them to the problem resolution team because that's what they're there for. If they talk to those folks, and so that would in one essence be a way of, some people may think of it as turning them away, but we're just rerouting them to the proper entity that might be able to, within the agency's resources, solve their problem or address their problem. They can come back to us if they don't feel that the problem resolution team has responded adequately, fairly, reasonably, whatever. So we have been averaging, it's generally been about 50-50, where we, 50%, 50%, where we go beyond just education on those complaints. Does that answer your question?
Follow up?
Partly. So let me restate your answer to make sure I understand it. You receive a call, complaint, and you determine whether it's jurisdictional or non-jurisdictional. If it's jurisdictional, you route the complainant through an internal complaint resolution process. If it's non-jurisdictional, you try to route the complainant to some independent complaint resolution process. Mm-hmm. Is that accurate?
So far, yes.
My question is, how many calls approximately do you get that are non-jurisdictional that would become jurisdictional if this community substitute became law?
Representative Christ Tompkins, through the chair, very few. Right now, very few. We don't get that many complaints about that category, certainly the juvenile justice aspect of complaints. When Hudson was up online and we had 1,500 inmates down at Hudson, we tracked the number of complaints, but it was maybe 7% of the complaints that we got in. And that the reality there is that word spreads through a prison population pretty quickly. If somebody calls the ombudsman to complain about conditions at a private prison and they're turned away, they're not going to tell their buddy that it does any good. But if somebody calls us and tells us that we handle their complaint and we find there's merit and we get something changed, then the word will spread. So it's hard to really measure the need for this by the number of cases that we would turn away because right now we turn them away, and so people don't see any success.
Anyway, from whom do you get most of your complaints? What area? I'm sure it changes from time to time, but what maybe the top two or three sources?
Mr. Chair, the right now that Goose Creek is online, the number of complaints from the Department of Corrections, primarily the inmate population, is the number one agency. I think that when I last checked, we were at about 28 or 29% of all complaints coming in this year have come from the Department of Corrections. Second is the Department of Health and Social Services. That was running last week, I think, at 27% of our caseload. And of that, I think 16 to 18% of all our overall caseload has come in complaints against the Office of Children's Services. After that, public assistance, the Department of Child Support is up there. I don't know. I haven't checked the exact number, the percentage. Child support, sometimes the troopers are up there. The cases that I generally track in the annual report are corrections, health and social services, OCS, public assistance, child support, the troopers, and that's about it.
Thank you. Representative Hughes, I think you had a comment or question.
Yes, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still going back to the patient health care provider. As the subcommittee chair mentioned, much of what we do is to protect citizens from government and that is why you exist. But in this case, I'm just a little concerned about the Alaskan and working with you to find that you have total access to those records. And I'm wanting to know how deep that access goes. And I know different providers could have volumes of healthcare records on a patient if they've been with that provider for a while. And I'm wondering how many people at your agency, at your office, would then have access to that. And then if it's dealing with a state agency, how many people at the state agency would have access to all that information? And do you educate the person that's coming to you that you will have access to that? Are they signing anything? Do they have any ability to limit what access you have to their medical records?
Representative Hughes, through the chair, the presumption is that if we get a complaint about a healthcare agency or Office of Children's Services, the complaint would be filed by either the parent or the grandparent, somebody who has a reasonable personal interest in a complaint. We do not accept and act on complaints filed by the neighbors about how a child is being treated in foster care, let's say. Or if we got a complaint from a neighbor who filed a report of harm and didn't believe it was acted upon, we cannot report back to them other than to say we believe that the agency has acted reasonably, or we believe that the agency, you know, we're looking at it, but we can't tell you under the law what it is we've seen. So we don't spread the records around. Our records remain in our office. We do not share records that we have obtained from an individual complainant with the agency, nor do we share records that we received from an agency with the complainant. If a complainant submits, we have special stamps. If a complainant submits records and they, at some later time, they come back and they want a copy of the records that they have provided us, we will provide them with a copy. But we don't serve as a conduit between for records to go back and forth from an agency to an individual. The presumption would be if somebody complained to us about an activity that they have given us permission to contact the agency and look at the records in the agency. There are some agencies that require a specific permission slip. We have long contended that we don't have to do that because we have the authority to access those records, but on occasion we have had complainants sign that document. Let's say an individual believes that information that's held in a private doctor's offices is necessary. We believe that's necessary to look at a complainant's request for an eligibility for some service. We would have them sign that permission, that waiver of confidentiality. There are 10 people in my office. Our office caseload is accessible by all people in the office. All individuals working for me are required to sign a confidentiality statement. We are required by law to keep our business confidential and not discuss it. We do on occasion consult with one another because that way you get a better investigative work product. We have some people I have one person in the office who's getting a master's degree in public health, so I consult with her an awful lot on areas that would be in that area of expertise. But we would not provide any information that would be confidential outside of our office. Does that answer the question or address your concerns?
Follow up. Thank you for that. So the state agency that's involved is not getting information back. That's good. There are 10 in your office that would have access to that information. The concern that I have is that it doesn't sound like you have a specific discussion. And I understand it's the person who's coming to you, the parent or the person that's had the problem. But it concerns me. They can be, you know, upset about what's happened and may not realize that you would have access to what could be volumes, And I would think that it would be appropriate for you to have a specific discussion that be part of your process, and even some an opportunity for them to sign something and to put parameters around what you might access in their medical records. And I am concerned that you don't, that is not in regulation right now, correct?
Representative Hughes, through the chair, it is, that is not something, that's standard practice, and I'm sorry that I didn't address that in my earlier response. It is our practice to inform individuals about what our investigative practice is. I don't know that I think that it would be necessary to put in regulation the fact, the need for us to explain this to individuals. It certainly would be something that, that would be proper in policies and procedures. But we do go through that process when we explain what we do and how we do it to our complainants. I'm just sorry I didn't address that when I answered your earlier question. But yes, it would be entirely proper for us to tell individuals what we're going to do. You also addressed the question of whether if an individual complainant did not want us to look at certain records, whether, you know, whether we would, they would be able to control that access to their records. If we get a complaint, our response depends on the nature of the complaint. If a parent is calling and saying that an agency, a foster home, whatever, is not allowing them to have visitation with their children, we don't need to look at all of the children's medical records to investigate that complaint. We would look at the appropriate information in a child's file. Did the therapist say that the parent was, access to the parent would be detrimental to the children's psychological well-being? If that was based on the advice of a therapist, and the therapist had access to the child and was treating the child, that would be our response. The therapist has recommended, based on their professional knowledge and their time spent interviewing the child and treating the child, that you not have access. But we wouldn't need to look at every note of the therapist that the therapist had or that was held in a residential facility for us to make that decision.
Okay, thank you. I'm just very concerned about the collection of private information.
Sure.
and wondering, just as another point we haven't talked about yet, when you put together your report, and there's even a provision you may present your opinion, would there ever be anything that would be in that report? I know it wouldn't be all revealing as far as someone's medical records, but could there actually be something in that report that would be reflective of the fact that you had access to those records that wouldn't be in that report otherwise? And I'm trying to think of an example where it might be something that a person might not want to be presented. And I guess I'll ask, when you have the right for in your public recommendation, it says may present opinion, are the names removed? Does the individual have any say whether that you ask the person involved if they're okay with it being presented publicly?
Representative Hughes, through the chair, our practice is that we do not, you know, we do post some reports online, some formal investigations online. Those investigations are either redacted or in some few cases, if the complainant has given us permission, we would include that online. But we haven't done that in probably 5 years. It's all, anything that we post online is redacted. Medical information is confidential. Although we would have access to review the medical information, we don't give that information out to individuals who do not have that access. The process would be, if we have a complaint, let's say a residential facility, we would write a report to the residential facility, which has access to that information. We would include in that report whatever interviews we conducted with whoever we needed to talk to. We would come to our conclusion, and we would notify the residential facility what the conclusion was based on all of that information. All of that medical information would be, if it's classified as confidential information and it's not something that the agency would provide, and we believe that that fulfills statutory and regulatory requirements, we would not provide that to, you know, we would give that to the agency that knows all of this information and needs to know what the basis of our report is, but we wouldn't go posting that on the internet or on, you know, on a website or even that level of detail in our closing summaries.
Follow up. So if the fact that the patient had hypertension and was bipolar, something like that would not be mentioned in any opinion that or a report that would go public. And if it had to do with care and treatment, are you just putting those in very general terms then that wouldn't reveal anything about the person then? Is that how you would handle it?
Representative Hughes, through the chair, yes. We take great steps to blur everything. And this is an area where we have not done that many. But I mean, I have had cases where I have not posted anything online because the even though the information was kind of out there in the community, the complainant didn't want, was requesting anonymity, and I did not want to do anything that would have indicated who the complainant was, and so nothing was posted online. There was no way to redact anything, so we just didn't post it at all. The agency got the response, the complainant got our finding, but we did not do anything to post online.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Eisen, did you have a question?
I just had a clarification, but I'll wait till after Representative Christ Tompkins.
Okay. Were you next? Yes, go ahead.
Thank you. I wanted to revisit a line of questioning that Representative Isaacson initiated about therapeutic foster parents. And I was reviewing the letter submitted by Kate Burkhart, and I wanted to ask if my understanding how these questions resolved is accurate, that there may or may not be clarity in the statute as presented in the CS whether therapeutic foster parents would be subject to the jurisdiction of the ombudsman, but that jurisdictional question would be resolved through regulation and therapeutic foster parents would be excluded from the ombudsman jurisdiction by regulation. Is that accurate?
Representative Christ Tompkins, through the chair, is my understanding of the CS is that we are not including therapeutic foster homes. And if that is mistaken, I will say that was certainly not our intent to sweep them up in this. And we tried very hard to get statutory specificity on what we were going to pick up. And so I think Ms. Burkhart and I may disagree on what we're getting at here, because as far as I can tell, we are not picking up therapeutic foster parents.
Follow up?
With the language as currently drafted, as Ms. Burkhart writes in her letter, a person under contract with a state agency to provide a residential treatment program, et cetera, would be under the jurisdiction of the ombudsman. How, to your mind, does that language exclude therapeutic foster parents?
To Representative Christ Tompkins, through the chair, is the language in the CS is, the specific language is to provide a residential child care facility or a residential psychiatric treatment center as defined in AS 4732-900, which has a couple of very specific definitions of what type of facility those are. And if you'll excuse me a moment, I'm going to pull out a copy of that statute. This is 4732 is the section of is the chapter dealing with licensing of a variety of entities, including assisted living homes and nursing facilities. But it also includes a residential child care facility, which is defined as a place staffed by employees where one or more children who are apart from their parents receive 24-hour care on a continuing basis. And my understanding is staffed by employees doesn't sound like a therapeutic foster home to me. I may be thoroughly mistaken, but that's certainly not what it sounds like. And a residential psychiatric treatment center, defined in this same statute, is a secure or semi-secure facility or inpatient program in another facility that provides, under the direction of a physician, psychiatric diagnostic evaluation and treatment services on a 24-hour-a-day basis to children with severe emotional or behavioral disorders.
Which statute is that?
This is 47.32.900.
Okay, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the we're talking about line 18, page 3 of the work draft, the CS. I guess my question, or at least I think my question, relates to lines 15 through 17, to provide a home as authorized by AS 4714.10 through 4714.50. So excluding the definition in line 18 and focusing on the definition lines 15 through 17, my question is, how do you see that this CS excludes therapeutic foster parents within the jurisdiction of the Ombudsman?
Through the chair to Representative Christ Tompkins, 4714 deals with essentially the equivalent of McLaughlin or specific work camps. It's an area that I don't think the state is currently using in the category of juvenile facilities. Basically, we're not talking about therapeutic placements. We're talking about correctional or detention facilities, I believe what they call a detention. They call it a home, but by that they mean an institution. 4714 deals with essentially the more correction-oriented placements for juveniles, and I don't think the state currently has any private entities that are providing that service, but it is there in statute as a potential.
So a home is sort of parlance within the correction and detentions world?
That is my understanding. Like I said, 4714 deals with a specific realm of placing juvenile delinquents, to be pretty blunt about it. And it's more on the delinquent aspect than it is on the therapeutic aspect.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We're getting close. Only about 5 minutes left. How much more would you have to cover? Because always, we've got seven folks who would like to testify, heavy-duty people out there in the very important sections of the bill. Obviously, we can't do that in 5 minutes, nor would we want to. So just for future planning here, how much more time will you guys need to complete this portion of it, your testimony here?
To the chair, I think we are pretty much done here. I would like to add a closing remark that
we're keeping public testimony open.
Okay.
And then we're going to call you back up, first up, at the next hearing on this. Go ahead.
To the chair, I think we've covered the basic points. I would like to add that for us, what you could call the cleanup provisions of the bill are essential, and we have asked that the legislature address these jurisdictional questions, but that, you know, basically our primary concern is that we need the statutory cleanup. And because we only come to the legislature once every few decades for a statutory revision, we are looking at the jurisdictional issues at the same time.
I'll be around and talk to you next time you come. Don't worry about it. Yeah. We have, I want to thank you for your very good testimony today. And we have because of the time constraints, we can't call you, but I would like to point out, and the audience are online to testify, we have Kate Burkhart from Alaska Mental Health Board. We have Steve Van Gore from Alaska Bar Association. He's counsel there. We have, looks like Jesse from the Mental Health Trust. We have Salinas of Wadwood, DHSS. We have Laura McKenzie, North Star Behavioral Health. We have Tom Chard from Behavioral Health Association. I'd like to thank all of you folks who signed up to testify. Sorry I couldn't get to you today, but it's a very weighty bill. We don't need to rush it. We need to move ahead with all deliberate speed, as said. But we don't want to rush it. We're obviously going to hear this again at the next possible time. I'd like to thank everybody. I apologize who didn't get to hear, but I think you will appreciate that we are going through this very carefully. The next committee referral, the Judiciary Committee, and we'll continue the discussion in Judiciary Committee after we move it out of here. But we're going to hear from these people who want to testify if they choose to try it again next time we do it. So I will put this back on the agenda at first available opportunity. And so I'm going to keep testimony open and any quickie remarks on this bill? If not, I'm going to put this bill on hold. And the next meeting, excuse me, Thursday, February 27th, we're going to hear the governor's appointments, Department of Administration, Curtis Thayer, Department of Public Safety, Gary Folger, and then HGR 24 on the Arctic Council. And then we're going to I've talked to my staff and see when we can schedule this again. But it will be just as soon as possible because we need to move this bill along. I hope we can move this bill out at the next committee meeting to send it on its journey to the Judiciary Committee. So any other comments, committee, on anything else? If not, I'd like to thank you for the hearing. We are adjourned at 10 o'clock.